Thank you very much for your invitation. So my talk is largely going to be based on the recent article that I and my colleagues published right now on Archive, and it is going to be about ocelons and especially large ocelons and effective field theory describing large ocelons. So for starters, let us first talk about what ocelons are. And we're going to start with a very simple example, which is actually going to be our prime example through the rest of the talk. Consider scalar field theory. You can see it here. It satisfies Klein-Gordon equation. And let us choose the potential V as a function of the field phi as hyperbolic tangents. And let us construct a field configuration and let us construct a Gaussian field configuration. We can see it actually here. So in three dimensions, right now for three dimensions. And let us watch how this field evolves in time, right? Okay, so we're going to see the movie now. You can see the movie.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So at first, the field starts to behave starts to exhibit some nonlinear behavior. You can see that its profile at its maximal value changes with time at first, and you can see here on the right that there are some waves going out. But as time passes, you can see here that the dotted lines do not change anymore or change not so significantly. So basically we have here a soliton which oscillates, and this soliton is called an ocelon. Now, the movie is going to stop now, but these oscillations of the three-dimensional field, you can see it's spherically symmetrical, are going to continue for a long time. In fact, as we have found out, well, in this case, in this model, the lifetime of an ocelon, of this ocelon exceeds 10 to the power of 5 of its periods. So the main question, it's quite interesting. Now, ocelons were found not only in this model. There are actually plenty of models in which ocelons were found. And they are actually a kind of a working horse in cosmology now. So for example, when people study generation of axion dark matter and they do numerical simulations. And well, this is actually a picture from the article by Vaquero, Redondo and Stadler. They actually see these ocelons pictured here as these dots, as these lumps. They actually see these ocelons and they see that they live for a long time and they can affect cosmological evolution. Well, this is not the only model where ocelons are found. For example, they may accompany cosmological phase transitions, or another example, a quite famous one, after inflation ends and the preheating phase of the universe evolution begins. So the inflaton field starts oscillating and it indeed can form an ocelon, as it was shown in several papers like by Amin, by Hong Kawasaki. And so, given the fact that oscillons are so ubiquitous across the field theoretical models, scalar field theoretical models, and given the fact that they can impact cosmological evolution, there exists a natural desire to find out why are they so long-lived. Now, once again, we saw in the movie that the oscillon appeared, and it looked like it is going to live for eternity. In fact, it does not live for eternity. It slowly, slowly, slowly decays until it eventually totally decays into waves. But indeed, it lives for a long time. And well, for some models, well, we have seen here that it's, well, I've written here that it's for 10 to the power of 5 periods. In some models, it's 10 to the power of 10 periods, so extremely long. And yet they decay. So the two questions are, why are they so long-lived and how can we describe them? So to date, there are several existing methods of describing them. Well, first of all, it's numerical, just. There are several numerical techniques to describe these long-living, such long-living configurations. And yes, of course, they involve some, trickery around, due to the fact that oscillons, that the evolution has to be made numerically for a very long time. Some, it is usually done with special numerical techniques. But what if we want some analytical description? Well, to date, the only model-independent analytical technique that describes oscillons is perturbative expansion. So that is, there is simple. We consider small amplitude, and wide oscillons, as you can see here, and moreover, we think we can, in this technique, people who do that consider that those two quantities are of the same order. Well, our goal basically is to develop description of oscillons at large field amplitudes, because, well, as we will find out later, for example, three-dimensional oscillons with very, very small field values are in fact unstable, and thus they are very difficult to be, it's very difficult to find them numerically. They just decay. The reasons we'll find out later. Okay, so having described our problem, we want to describe oscillons at large field values. Let us start with the effective field theory. So, okay, once again, our main idea, we want large-sized oscillons, but we want wide oscillons. So we consider their size to be big, and thus spatial derivative of fields to be small. But we do not impose any constraints on the field value, phi. So in the zero order approximation, let us see what happens with our Klein-Gordon equation. In the zero order approximation, let us, for the time being, neglect the spatial derivative of phi, as you can see here. We will get ourselves a very fine thing, a nonlinear oscillator, which is depicted here. It is exactly solvable. A very good way to write its solutions, solution to its equation, are action angle variables. So if somebody forgot, we can make a canonical transformation from the coordinate and momentum coordinates, from from coordinate and momentum to action and angle. And so that the energy, the Hamiltonian, will depend only on one of two coordinates, on action. Explicit expressions are given here, well, up to coefficients. And the classical solution to the nonlinear oscillator equation in this case is that the action variable remains constant throughout the evolution, and the angle variable changes progressively and linearly with the speed of change being the mechanical frequency, here denoted as big omega. Big omega actually depends on the, also depends only on angle, on action variable. It, well, you can see here, it can be found by differentiating Hamiltonian over action. Well, it's not from mathematical point of view, from analytical point of view, a very simple transformation. For example, for our model, for our chief example, the value, the field, or well, the classical coordinate and the Hamiltonian are expressed as this. So while the field here has some cumbersome expression in terms of action and angle, Hamiltonian appears to be fairly simple. And well, this is actually one of the prime reasons why we chose this model, because, well, we use it as an example. So we do not want to encounter unnecessary technical difficulties. In general case, the field and its derivative are given as a function through the some functions of action and angle of I and theta. Okay, so this is the mechanical picture, right? No special special derivative. Action is constant, angle changes progressively. Let's return to the field theory.
Yeah, my ask here.
So, and we have.
Yeah, I have a question. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, is it a good approximation? Because now this frequency omega or big omega, it depends on the amplitude of the field, right? And it means like the different points of this oscillon will oscillate with different frequencies. So it will look like it will decohere. Yeah.
And based on that, that's a good point. Later we will show, show it now, that for our effective field theory to work, omega as a function of I should not vary very much at the values of I, which is interesting, where we, at the values of I, which our oscillon is expected to take.
Mm-hmm.
We will talk about it later, but that's a very good point.
Okay, let's see.
Here omega is a function of I, but yeah. So let us return to the field theory. And here, so now action I and theta are not just action and angle, they are fields depending on the special coordinate x. So let us derive effective action now that we know, now that we take into account the special derivative term. So here is our action. Here is our mechanical part, which can be rewritten as I partial, in terms of action and angle, as I partial theta over derivative of theta over time, and minus Hamiltonian. Well, it's a classical rewriting. But here we have another term, which is subleading. Why it is subleading? Well, it has two special derivatives, and we consider our oscillons to be white. So each special derivative is to the order of epsilon size to the power of minus one. So it is subleading term. And what we do with this subleading term, we average it over period. Well, why? Because we have already here integral over time, integral over t. So we can say that, well, okay, when we write action, we already average it over many periods. So let us introduce averaging explicitly into the Lagrangian. How do we average it? Remember, we expect that in classical mechanics, theta evolves progressively. So, and here we expect theta to evolve progressively with the same speed all over the space. So here we average it not, we change averaging over time to averaging over period of theta. Yes, you have a question.
Hi, yes. So inside the oscillon, I would expect the theta to progress at one rate, but far away inside the radiation zone, I might expect it to oscillate faster. Is that not the case?
We do not consider radiation here. And a little teaser that we are building an approximate theory, right? And in this approximate theory, we will get oscillons which do not radiate, which do not decay. In the same fashion as you have read the articles by Fodor and others about small amplitude expansion. They also have exactly periodic solution at every level of their perturbation theory.
But these are infinite still, energy solutions, so they're unphysical.
Yeah, we will get a finite energy solution here, which is exactly periodical, but we will get it in approximate theory. So basically, we're building right now approximate theory in which we are going to have exactly periodic solutions. And this, we will treat them as our oscillon approximations of the oscillon. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so yeah, the assumption here is that all of the field oscillates with the same frequency. Okay, so now expanding the special derivative of phi into special derivatives of I and theta here, we obtain these three terms, in which actually the latter one cancels due to symmetry reasons. Actually, this average is zero. So here we have two remaining terms. The first is partial derivative of I squared with a form factor which is I dependent, and analogously, we have a partial derivative of theta with its own form factor, which is also I dependent. So after plugging it in the effective action here, we obtain the effective action in the leading order. So here are our mechanical terms that are here since like our mechanical example. And here is what have become of spatial derivative of phi. It now transformed into different terms with two special derivative of two different fields. So if that if action might seem unknown to you, or well, unfamiliar, let me introduce a complex field. We can pack real valued fields I and theta into a complex field, using the expression given here. Oh, sorry. And in this case, our action transforms a little bit, and its kinetic term here takes the form of a kinetic term in a nonlinear Schrödinger model. Of course, it's not the exactly nonlinear Schrödinger equation. Well, you have here also two form factors, which are a combination of mu I and mu theta. But it's similar, so it's a good way to think about it as a modified nonlinear Schrödinger equation. Here we have H Hamiltonian and all form factors dependent only on absolute value of psi squared. So this model has global symmetry. In terms of theta, it's just a shift in theta to theta plus some auxiliary, some arbitrary angle alpha. In terms of psi, it's just a U1 shift, like an electromagnetic field, but it's global. So we have Noether theorem tells us that whenever we have global symmetry, we have conserved charge, and indeed we have one. Integral of I over all of space is conserved. So, and this is exactly what will bring us the solitons. Well, if you remember, cue balls. This is exactly how they are. This is exactly how they were built by Coulomb. So we have an attractive potential, and we have charge conservation. So basically, if we switch to a particle description, we have basically particles attracting together. But if we treat lumps as particles, we have particles attracting together, but without the ability to disappear because their number is conserved. So this is a nice picture. Well, how it looks like. So yeah, outside here, no particles, all particles are here.
So yeah, so I think I have a question. So what type of solutions you are looking for, you know, in terms of this I and theta? So you want I to be time independent, is it? And theta to be only linear?
We want...
Can you elaborate more? What type of solutions you're looking for?
Well, now we can... Yeah, well, we are looking for a solution which is localized, and we're looking for a localized solution. So there are two ways of doing it. And which oscillates. So we expect I to be time independent and theta to evolve progressively. Mm-hmm. So we can use stationary ansatz. This is here, so phi, which was a function of t and time and spatial coordinate. We can express it as we can separate spatial dependent part and time dependent part, which is actually the same if we remember the definition of psi here, which basically means that theta evolves progressively.
Mm-hmm.
If we do not want to...
So you have this equation, that you write like eigenvalue equation, like on the slide. Yeah, and that, what I'm confused about that it's very important for it to have this gradient term, because otherwise, there would be no solution, right? Because omega depends on psi non trivially. So the gradient term is important here. I'm trying to understand. On the other hand, you are making some expansion in gradients, so. Yeah, how that should be understood? Because naively, this expansion gradients should mean that just gradients are small perturbations, but here they seem to be very important.
Well, here we have it because actually, for our theory to work, omega small and omega large, which is a function of I, also should be close. So basically, this term is small. This term is small, but the difference of these two terms is also small.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So we take stationary ansatz.
Sorry to interrupt again. So that means that it's, in some sense it's a small amplitude solution, right? Because you don't want this omega to deviate too much from. At least in terms of I, which is a small amplitude deviation, something like this,
It's not in terms of I. It means that it means that omega is it means that omega as a function of I very very slowly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that later. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we're just constructing the solution. Well, alternatively, so we have talked about the ansatz. Well, there is one, if we do not want to use the ansatz, and we do not believe in ansatzes, and we want to do everything like from scratch, we can just minimize the energy, which is H plus gradient terms at fixed charge N, which doing so basically by constructing an auxiliary functional E minus omega N, and later by comparing the equation for the oscillon profile and later, well, comparing the variations of this new functional and the old action, we can deduce that our Lagrange multiplier omega is basically the same as frequency. So just the ansatz is just a quicker way of doing things. If you do not want to use it, okay, you can do it. Just you can do it. You can live without it. Yeah. So okay. Another thing worth mentioning is that if we minimize the energy at fixed charge, this means that it's the variation of energy equals the variation of the resulting functional equals zero on the oscillon for all variations. And so basically from here we can deduce an important expression which connects the frequency omega, the energy E, and the charge N. So basically, omega is the derivative of E over M, over N. Now, if you want some physical interpretation, you can always interpret N as number of particles. And in this case, omega being the derivative of energy over number of particles is being the energy of a new particle, or in thermodynamical language, chemical potential. So this is basically a physical interpretation of this quantities. Okay, so yeah, let us switch to an example. And our example, this is our old flat potential hyperbolic tangent squared. And we are now going to consider it in just one dimension. So we have a spatial dimension. So we have time t and coordinate x. In this case, this the differential equation written here is integrable. And well, yeah, we can write its solution analytically. Not very nice, but well. Yeah, it's actually it's given as an implicit function as the solution is actually phi as a function of x, but here it's written vice versa. So well, for omega, for the frequency omega, one frequency omega, it's plotted here. Well, yeah, you can see that it's nicely localized. Now, if we want to go back to the field, to physical field, to phi, well, we can do so. We know the transformation function, which expresses phi as a function of I and theta. So here, theta is omega time, and I is psi squared. We can see by we can deduce by studying this expression that here are tends to infinity in the case when omega tends to one. Now, one here is actually the mass of the field, because when you expand the potential, you'll find out that its mass is one. The charge and the energy, one more important thing. So we can actually compare it. We can actually compare the profile, the phi, as a function of x at its maximum with the profile of numerical oscillon, with the profile of the oscillon obtained numerically. So you can see here that it coincides pretty well here at omega close to one, but not very close. Yeah. So we can also compute here, in this case, analytically, the charge and the energy. And we, so they both, as you can see, are dependent on omega, on the frequency. And we can compare also these dependencies with real life, with that dependencies of real life oscillons. So you can see here that at omega close to one, it coincides almost exactly, but as omega becomes smaller and further from one, from the mass, we start seeing some discrepancies. Okay, so now actually, we're moving closer to Sergei's questions. A question about omega small and omega large, but first, one important note. In the effective field theory, if one remembers the whole science about cue balls, you can remember that, sometimes cue balls exist, sometimes they do not exist. There have to be, there are certain requirements to be fulfilled. The same is here. So in our effective field theory, we can derive existence conditions on the oscillon. And for now, conditions that the potential has to satisfy for oscillons to be in the model. Okay, so here we will formulate them in terms of omega big, which is our mechanical frequency, and it's I dependent, and I zero, which is I, which is the field I, the action field at the center of the oscillon. So it's
first of all,
the first condition is that mechanical frequency should be at the maximal, at the center of the oscillon, should be smaller than the mass of the field. So you can see here, this is our mechanical potential in the mechanical model. The ball oscillates with frequency omega big. Well, it has to be smaller than the mass of the field, which then the mass, which is actually frequency around zero, of oscillations around zero. Another condition, which is somewhat maybe harder to explain, is this one. Well, what it basically says, that the same condition about the mechanical frequency should be satisfied on average from I equals zero to I equals I naught, because basically H over I naught is averaged mechanical frequency, but averaged over the interval from zero to I naught. So basically it says that in most parts, for most values of I from zero to I naught, mechanical frequency, this one, should be smaller than the mass. And another condition here is that our EFT should not become singular. This means that our coefficient mu I should not become zero, because as you can remember, here it is in the denominator. So, but it should not happen if our EFT is built from the existing field theory, because, well, actually, one over mu I is averaged average of a square. But this is important if we try to restore the field theory from the effective theory. Well, for example, we want to build a field theory with oscillons inside. So we may start with effective field theory and then restore the original one. So in this case, for the field theory, well, to be restorable, this condition should also be satisfied. Right, so these are the existence conditions. Now to the point of, to Sergei's point. Indeed, from profile equations, we can see here that omega minus omega minus big omega is proportional to the second derivative, that is to MR to the power of minus 2. So for the field theory to work, d omega over di should be smaller than, well, big omega over I. And this actually is the condition for our EFT to work. But not only is it, But it's not only the condition for the EFT. It's also the condition for the oscillon longevity. So you see here, we have constructed an EFT where we have solitons, oscillons, which are eternal because we have conserved charge. So it prohibits their decay. But our theory, but effective field theory is approximate. Its accuracy is basically determined by how small d omega over di is. So that is the condition for oscillon's longevity. What it means in terms of the potential v as a function of field phi, we'll talk about that a little later. But now let us turn our attention to another important property, and that is linear stability of oscillons. There's a famous criterion called Vahitov-Kolokolov criterion, and it can be proved for our effective field theory as well, despite the fact that some of the terms here are non-standard. Well, yeah, for example, graded terms have additional form factors, field-dependent form factors, I-dependent. And the Vahitov-Kolokolov criterion basically says that, n as a function of omega. If it decreases, we're in the clear. Our oscillon is stable. If it's not, we'll see one example of that later. There does exist a perturbation that breaks down our soliton, our oscillon. Right. So how can we? A question.
Yes. I just have a question. Does your formalism handle if the oscillon is a sum of two frequencies that are not related by an integer rate or by, you know, some integer ratio? This is something that can happen before.
I mean, incomparable frequencies.
Yeah, for example.
We find the solution which has one frequency.
Okay, because before the Vakhitov-Kolokolov conditions are violated, you can have an oscillon that becomes a sum of multiple frequencies.
If frequencies are not comparable,
we can discuss later. It's fine.
Because in our formalism we just don't have the room for two frequencies. Like even if we're not using stationary ansatz here, right? We minimize the energy at fixed charge. We have one Lagrange multiplier. We write down the equation, and by comparing the equation for obtained from varying the effective action itself and the functional e minus omega n. This is just one. I think we do not describe that. We actually did not think about that. Right. So far we have formulated our existence conditions and longevity conditions through the values or through the functions of the action I, like h as a function of I big omega, which is derivative of H over I, etc. Now we want now to switch back to the potential V. It can be done using this formula here. It's quite a famous problem, like to restore the potential knowing the period, knowing the dependence of period over energy. This is basically the same problem, and the formula is known. Yeah, so here it is. It's an integral. Here, of course, omega, yeah. So omega as is given as a function of h. Basically, it appears that there are two ways of achieving the desired condition of small varying omega, or omega, big omega. So that big omega remains almost constant. First, indeed, as Sergei pointed, is a small amplitude approximation where we just consider small fields, and we work here. We work with small fields. However, there do exist special cases of flat omega as a function of I. So, for example, we can take omega as omega naught plus some small correction, delta omega. And in this case, plugging this into the formula which gives us phi phi as a function of V, or vice versa, V as a function of phi, we can get an almost quadratic potential. So V is so basically a quadratic potential, but with the coefficient here, omega tilde squared, being almost constant, but with also with a small addition, and this small addition of being like the large integral. This case was one of the known potentials which falls into this category is so-called monodromy potential. So you can see it plotted here. Nice. It's printed here. It's actually can be described as the power potential phi to the power of 2p, p like latent p, where p tends to 1. So for example, you can see here, this is here in dotted lines is also quadratic potential, and here we have monodromy potential for p equal to 1.1. so in this case omega varies, big omega varies slowly, and the oscillons are long-lived. So basically, there's an article by Ole and Pujolas, where they study oscillons in this model, and they are long-lived. So this agrees with our intuition that if the criterion works, then it works. The better this criterion works, the longer the oscillons live. A limiting case here is also potential phi squared over logarithm phi. It's not regular, but it can also be considered as a limiting case. And in the logarithmic potential, there exists an absolutely periodic solution. But the problem with this is calculating action and angle. Right, so having discussed that, let's return to our goal. So
Vasily, can you hear me?
question?
Yeah, you have about 10 minutes.
Yeah, okay. Well, okay. It's going to be quick. Because our goal is to develop asymptotic expansion in 1 over r squared or 1 over m r squared. So our goal is to have the effective action as like terms that are proportional to r to the power of minus 2 and, well, to the power of 0, but which cancel themselves to the power of minus 2. Then have some additional term and another, which are, well, corrections. So now I'm going to quickly review how we derive that term. The first term here s effective second. So we considered our fields to be slow varying in time, if at all. So now let delta I and delta theta. Unlike I bar and theta bar, which are now our slow varying fields from the previous part of the talk, they are fast oscillating and they have zero average. Plugging it into the action, we can obtain the equations for them. Solve these equations. Well, you can see that it's, well, rather daunting task. And obtain the solutions as a function only of slow variables of I bar and theta bar here. And later, plug the result into the action, obtaining once again the second order correction only in terms of slow varying fields. So in terms of I bar and theta bar, which we once again equate to omega tau, omega t, we can do that because once again we can show that conservation law isn't broken, and thus oscillons exist and stationary ansatz passes. So here is the result. Two things to note. First, we have here four spatial derivatives in each term, so that desire is fulfilled. And our form factors depend only on phi squared. Well, here phi is already real. It's basically I bar. Oscillon profile from this action can be found, well, perturbatively. So we know the oscillonic profile from the first order action. And then we can consider correction to it and solve what is basically a linear equation, although with some nasty coefficients. Having solved that, we can then return to the field value, the function phi of time and coordinate, and substitute not only, and in this case, so now that we're considering fast oscillating corrections delta I, also we have to plug in here not only our new I bar, which is basically a sum of the original profile and the correction obtained from the second order action, But also we have to put in here delta I and delta theta, which in turn are functions of I and I bar and theta bar, which is equal to omega t. So here is the result. You can see it here. You may remember from on one of the previous slides, we had this picture, but only with blue line, and we said that it almost coincides. Well, now it really coincides. It coincides better than the leading order EFT. So basically, our EFT converges. Yeah, and so this may be our final slide. Let's see how our theory works in terms of E of energy, or as a function of omega, or charge as a function of omega. Well, they have due to the property that we have discussed between those three quantities, they actually have the same profile. So let's first look at three-dimensional oscillon, three-dimensional case. Well, first of all, quantitatively not very good. Qualitatively, okay. We managed to, even in the leading order, to grasp both branches of the oscillon. So remember Vahitov-Kolokolov criterion. It works both with E and with energy E and with the charge N. Here we have an unstable branch, and you can see it here. We don't have numerical data here because those oscillons decay very fast, very quickly. For two-dimensional and one-dimensional case, we don't have unstable branches. All things is stable up to omega equals almost one. And we can see that, first in all three cases, our second order gets us closer to real live data than the leading order EFT. And second, it works better at omega closer to one, which is not no surprise because this is actually small amplitude approximation. It's closer, but unexpectedly it works better the smaller dimension is, like 3, 2, 1. The answer to that is that basically let's go below one dimension. And in this case, we have the case basically the center of the field decouples from the rest of the field. We have the oscillator at the center, which oscillates like a mechanical oscillator, and gives periodic boundary conditions for the rest of the field for the bulk. And so this might serve as an explanation why our theory works better at smaller d. Right, so let's wrap it up. This is just a comparison between our method and small amplitude expansion, notably in small amplitude expansion that at three dimensions in the leading order, it fails to capture the stable branch where we have the data. We capture it, but in three dimensions, our EFT works worse than in one dimension. You see here, here we're almost in the second order, we are almost there. Right, so what have we done in our work? So we constructed an effective field theory for the oscillons in which the sole parameter of our expansion is MR minus squared. So for larger zones. In this effective field theory, we have a global U1 symmetry, which gives us oscillons. So we have discussed the conditions for existence of such long-lived oscillons. At first, our potential has to be attractive and nearly quadratic. So at d equals zero, we have exact oscillons, because something I have not said on this slide is that we have a periodic boundary condition. So basically, from the core, from the oscillator at the core of the oscillon, so the rest of the field relaxes with time to periodic solution, as you also can see here, where 10 to the power of 5 periods have passed, and well, the field configuration hasn't changed at all. And in generic models, I forgot to put here plus and dots, dots, dots. There is a problem of constructing phi as a function of I and theta, because in many models there is no analytic expression. Well, in this case, we can use express it as a series, as semi-integer series to the power of I, and this can basically, and the small amplitude expansion can actually be deduced from it in the generic case. So what else can be done? Two interesting problems. One is we have discussed this very good monodromy potential, which allows large wide oscillons because it's very close to quadratic, and it would be interesting to build EFT for it. Well, it's technically challenging. And another interesting problem is, well, how do oscillons decay? How do oscillons decay? In EFT, they do not decay. At every order of EFT, we have conserved charge. It's an interesting problem. How to go out of EFT and describe their decay. Right. So thank you for your attention. Sorry for being a little over time. If you have any questions, feel free to ask them. Okay, David was first.
Thank you for the talk. So I've been trying to understand the statement that the decay of oscillons is non-perturbative in your EFT. And from what I could tell from the derivation, it seems like decay processes are set to zero because of this time averaging procedure you have. Okay. So
yeah, time averaging.
Maybe it's a semantic thing. Is this really non-perturbative or just simply a limitation of the formalism, or?
Well, our EFT is built on the averaging. It's the core thing. Well, the core thing that happened when we passed from this to this is we basically averaged our special derivative. This gave us charge, and this gave us oscillons. So without that, no conserved charge, and we arrive at the same problem again: how to describe oscillons.
I see. And one more thing. So as far as your formalism becoming worse as d goes up, perhaps something to try are what's called flat top oscillons. And these can circumvent the Vakatov-Kolokolov conditions. If you make the flat top appear at, you can tune where the flat top appears. And so this could allow you to describe omega very close to one in three dimensions.
You mean in a three-dimensional case?
Yes.
Yes, but once again, the problem with some of potentials, including I think flat top, is well, how to compute these quantities? Because look, mu I is because mu I is tough even for Sine Gordon. Like there is no known analytic expression. So yeah, this is sort of a shortcoming. Well, but yeah, well, yeah, we might use a series. Yeah. So yeah, thank you for your advice.
Thank you.
Now I think Sergey had a question.
Well, I also thank you for the talk. So yeah, I'm trying to understand your well, basically your expansion. So. And to what extent is different from just non-relativistic expansion? So is it this trick that kind of you do actually gradients not of phi but of I, yeah, of these action variables? Yeah, so you're expanding in gradients of action variable, and this can be for some specific cases, it can be kind of better expansion parameter than just non-relativistic expansion. Is it the right way to interpret your results, or is just non-relativistic expansion?
Large-sized oscillons. We can describe large-sized oscillons if potential provides permits. So once again, for example, where we have it here, right? In this potential where our EFT works for large phi, why not? Well, the only problem is technical, and here is exactly the point where. A non-relativistic approach is not applicable because, well, we have large fields here.
Yeah, but for me, large fields is different from non-relativistic. For me, non-relativistic is really about gradients, yeah, and frequencies. Yeah, if the frequency is close to the mass, and if the gradient is small compared to the mass, then this is non-relativistic. So I don't know. I don't see why the amplitude should be small necessarily in this context. Why should people use this small amplitude expansion? Why they needed that at all? I don't understand.
That's a good question. Why people use? Well, maybe because it was long known that in the small amplitude. The small amplitude expansion was like long well known for a long time, because even in like 1980s people studied quasi breathers there, which mm-hmm. are basically also a way to describe oscillons. Well, basically what these guys are doing further and et al. Yeah, these guys they are basically describing oscillons as quasi breathers.
Mm-hmm.
our method works for if omega as a function of I varies slowly. Yeah, mm-hmm. and yeah, is actually close to omega small.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any more questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.